you, Sam, what's new with you, Gutta, today?
Yeah, so there was an interesting piece of news and probably speculation happening in Khalid's, so about the whole cyber war situation between Russia and Ukraine. So first there was a...
Sam, let me interrupt you. Let's wait before we discuss this a few more minutes until other people can join, so we don't have to repeat it again.
Yeah.
I was just making it small talk just to see how your day went until some people came in, that's all.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. But it's just, obviously, apart from the latest stuff which happened today, then, of course, if we look at the previous cyber attacks happening, still seeing situation with the with attackers on both sides attacking each other's national infrastructure, and also banks and government websites. So this is still ongoing. I think this was one of the latest topics. Of course, everyone is discussing the capability on both sides, I think there were quite a lot of news around the ISP hacking, satellite hacking, which I think we will discuss a bit later.
Absolutely.
But also there was an interesting piece of news on Sky earlier today, where basically they were trying to see whether Russia will actually launch a cyber attack on the West.
Interesting. It reminds me of the last couple of weeks, how a lot of the Western media were talking about how Russia may be preparing to do some kind of a chemical attack in Ukraine, which is fascinating to me because Russia got rid of its chemical stockpiles a few years back, and none of its military hardware is equipped for this kind of thing. But it's become the conversation and the debate on speculation on Western media for the last couple of weeks, which I find fascinating. But let's do this. We're going to dig straight in. One of the things that I wanted to bring to the as a topic for this group and this particular conversation today as the latest development, and it really goes to the heart also, we're starting now. It goes to the heart of the question that I put out there saying, is Russia-Ukraine cyber war about to escalate exponentially? There are certain activities and certain events that have taken place today that lead me to the conclusion that the cyber war between Russia and Ukraine is about to escalate exponentially, and I'm going to touch on this, and I'll bring in Sam to go into more details about that. One of them is how Ukraine is recruiting an IT army of cyber warriors. And in fact, it appears one of the Western nations, a democracy, Australia, is considering making this legal so that people from all over the world can actually start helping Ukraine in its cyber in its cyber warfare. And that to me is fascinating. One of the things I find quite daunting is the prospect of sides, whoever who are involved in any particular battle, to now be able to utilize legality in bringing in support or mercenaries, if you want to call it that. And does that mean that the cyberspace is about to become the OK Corral? We're going to be in the wild, wild west or the wild, wild cyber? This is very, very daunting to me, and I will ask Sam to elaborate more on the specifics on the call for the Ukraine to recruit an IT army. And my understanding also, they really want to give those cyber warriors they're recruiting in other parts of the world the protection of operating from their own consulate, Ukrainian consulate and embassies. Therefore, they would not be subject to the laws of the nation state they operate in, and that would give them diplomatic protection. Fascinating development. So I'm waiting to see what Sam can give us more details on this, and open it for the conversation and the debates, and perhaps we can really try to get come to a consensus. Is this worrying, or is this something that will allow us to sleep well at night? Sam, the floor is yours.
Yes, thanks, Khaled. Yeah, this was quite a worrying piece of news appearing today, because Australia apparently today is voting on a whole bunch of laws related to cybersecurity, and that includes some cyber response. And even though this, my understanding is that this has not been yet accepted, but this was one of the proposals, and that is what I saw, where the suggestion was to set up something called cyber militia. And basically that was...
Sorry, Sam, you mean the Australian Parliament has not adopted it as a law or as a resolution yet?
No, there was a different set of laws which were being discussed today. But this was just a proposed, this is called the Proposed Cyber Militia Bill. And basically this was basically a discussion in this bill around whether the Australians should be barred outright from joining Ukraine's cyber fight. And that was basically an attempt to introduce some sort of legislation to create some legal safeguards for people. And I think this is this was a topic of discussion, whether Australians should be allowed, or whether that's a member of the foreign state-run cyber militia which can operate, which is very, very interesting, because I think that's one of the unprecedented things. Because as you mentioned, Khalid, the big piece of news is Ukraine's IT army or a cyber army, which was set up by the Ukraine's vice prime minister, who is also the digital transformation minister, Mr. Mikhail Fedorov. So he called up on hacker talents to join the cyber resistance effort. And I think the latest figures was anything between 275,000, now approaching 300,000 volunteer hackers from all around the world answering this call and basically performing tasks to attack targets in Russia, in Russian cyberspace. And I think this is also an unprecedented thing. But as a sort of side speculation from it, due to invite more people, because obviously on many countries, including Australia, running any sort of cyber attack is illegal. And it's this call for the Ukrainian embassies and Ukrainian consulates all around the world to open their doors to volunteers who want to walk into the Ukrainian embassy or Ukrainian consulate and perform cyber attacks against Russia from there, being protected, because obviously they will be technically on Ukrainian soil. So Khaled, what do you think about this this interesting development?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated that on one side we're hearing that the existing laws of Australia prohibit such activity, but any adaptation to existing laws opens a complete can of worms, because the one thing that we know for a fact when it comes to the international cyberspace is it's lacking some significant treaty style cooperation between many parties, and this is why a lot of things that should be happening, whether it's done through the UN or multilateral governmental agencies, there's something that needs to happen, because we're really at risk at any particular time for a domino effect that goes beyond any capability of any single country to control it, because it will escalate exactly exponentially. So I'm actually worried about this, because then in every issue or debate or invasion, you have multiple sides that are taking, you know, who take one side versus the other. It opens up the door for other sides to do the same thing. And what does that mean? It means everybody's going to be, has become a gunslinger or a gunslinger for hire or a volunteer. in cyberspace, the entire infrastructure, I'm speaking here from experience, you know, the entire infrastructure of the internet as a network of networks did not have security as a component at the time it was built. It was created, and the security came afterwards, because the whole system was designed to be an intranet, a system for the defense sector in the US and some universities. That's it. And all of a sudden now we're adding these new layers. It's so vulnerable to exploitation. And the minute it gets to that scale of possible exploitation, I would venture a bet this could take a step back to the dark ages. That's my two cents.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the things like treaties, because I think earlier we discussed that Microsoft raised an interesting point about the breaching of Geneva Convention in cyberspace, and basically asking to consider some of the cyber attacks to be considered as war crimes. So what do you think? Are we now in a world where cyber attacks can be considered war crimes?
You know what? That leaves a lot of that puts it in a very big speculative angle. It's not as firm as when you're talking about the Declaration of Human Rights. This, you can go to the Human Rights Declaration at the UN, you can read it, you know where you stand. Governments are signatories as members on this region. For example, the non-nuclear proliferation, this has a treaty. Governments and the UN have a format under which they actually operate under, and you can hold a lot of countries accountable. This is part of the reason why many countries are finding it difficult to develop nuclear capabilities, etc. But when it comes to cyber, there is very little that's already in place, and primarily it's because, the way I see it, because I've been involved in many of these discussions at UN level, many times what you see is there is little interest by the main parties to actually collaborate to have a treaty in place, as long as, because that treaty might end up tying their hands down. If you recall, I'm just going by memory now, a couple of years ago when the US and Russia were getting into serious concerns about cyber attacks, I can't remember what the specifics were, but I recall very vividly the U.S. was pushing on some kind of an understanding, but they never really pushed to having a treaty in place. I personally believe the threat landscape is exploding so fast that we need to find something that can hold back many nation states and their cybersecurity agency or the security agencies from actually doing whatever they want, because the law does not hold it down. The international law does not hold them down or limit their capabilities. That's a big concern. So I do not believe what Microsoft was calling for is linking the activity of cyber to some kind of a treaty that exists on the books. That is a tall order to try and make it stick. I don't see it sticking or working. It's just an angle or narrative. We need something far more potent and more urgent than that.
And since the topic of the room, and of course we talk about cyber war, one thing I want to ask you is, of course, about cyber warfare. So, you know, you talk a lot about geopolitical cyber warfare, but what is cyber warfare, and what's the difference between that and the geopolitical cyber aspect of it?
General, that's a very good question, and this is precisely why we chose to call this group cyber warfare, because people can relate to cyber warfare. But unfortunately, we relate to it when there is a war going on. So, with all respect to all of the attendees, if there had not been the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, chances are most people around the world would not have realized there's a war going on. The difference here is, they don't think there's a war going on because there's a cyber war going on, because there is no war going on. So, but however, this is the big however, the geopoli-cyber warfare has been raging for the last 10 years, ongoing, and in fact, there have been times in private briefings and private conversations, I've labeled it the silent, undeclared WW3. And the reason for that here is geopolicyber warfare, which is the act of nation states and their security agencies attempting successfully often to compromise the defenses, the cyber defenses of other nations, not for profit, but for political, ideological, religious, or economic, to try and coerce that nation states to taking a different political or ideological stance as a government. Yes. This has been happening for the last 10 years, ongoing and nonstop. The only difference here is in the first 5 years of the last decade, most people did not realize it was happening routinely. The first escalation, for most people who will relate to this, is when the US election in 2016 was labeled as interfered through cyber attacks and through social media, et cetera, which we fake news, false narrative, which we've labeled as purpose disinformation. So in the most recent 5 years, geopolicyber warfare, even though when wars were not declared between two nations or multiple nations, these geopolicyber warfares were happening on daily basis, and it's a chess game, and everybody has been at it. Anybody that says to you, we don't do that, look at them, smile. You don't have to call them liars, but just look at them and smile and say you know better. Everybody has been doing it, and in fact, there have been numerous geopolicyber attacks on government installations in different parts of the world to advance a political agenda. One case in point, I'll remind, I don't know if there's anybody from the Middle East, if anybody remembers how Qatar versus Saudi Arabia and the UAE ended up in an absolute nightmare of brother against brother, blockades for a number of years. Well, guess what? It started by a cyber attack, which of the Qatari Information Ministry, attributing words to the Emir of Qatar, which he never said, and within hours, everything was already in place, within hours, the domino effect stopped moving forward and kicking in, and within a day or two, Saudi Arabia and UAE offered ultimatums, gave ultimatums to Qatar to do A, B, and C, or there would be a blockade, and then a huge blockade took place. These were brothers. These were part of the same community. This is they're part of the Gulf Cooperation Council, which means every citizen from one country can operate and work in the other country, no restrictions. And all of a sudden now, they became enemies. So there are numerous examples to illustrate this. So why we call the Russia-Ukraine cyber war a geopolicyber warfare, because all of the cyber attacks have become a component of the way the war takes place, a component of the media and the propaganda by both sides and their partners, and the truth, it becomes the biggest victim. So if you don't, and one key point here is, if you, one thing what I've been saying for the last 10 years, if you can't name the threat, you cannot mitigate the threat. And therefore, if you keep calling it cyber war, and there's a ceasefire, the majority of people will assume the cyber war has stopped. Wrong. The ceasefire might stop cessation of physical violence, but the cyber warfare, the geopolicyber warfare, will continue nonstop, because there is nothing that holds back any of these people. And now we're seeing the escalation taking place through certain countries considering legalizing the volunteering or the acquisition of mercenaries to try and help. And guess what? Anybody that has money can do this, and then that means we're really gonna go into oblivion. I hope that explains it better, Sam. If I fail to, please point it out.
No, I think that was a good explanation. And obviously, just going back to the sort of traditional cyber warfare, what we call it from the technical side, obviously I can approach it from the technical explanation, is, again, for the benefit of the audience, give you an example of the some of the cyber warfare tools, because there are, traditionally, there is a dark market or on the dark web on the internet where a lot of these cyber warfare tools used to be on sale. I'll give you an example that probably everyone will understand. One of the cyber warfare examples is vulnerability, which allows whoever has this particular cyber warfare tool to shut down all Apple iPhones in a particular area or in a country. So this kind of cyber warfare tool was on sale, I think, probably in 2012 on the black market, on the dark market. And I think that was purchased by unknown nation state, by government, for approximately $1 million. And there was another one, which again, to give an example, this was a set of credentials, basically using a password to access a railway system in a different country. And we know very well, Khalid, I think I'm going to ask you to comment on the attack on the Belarusian railway recently, which actually disrupted the weapons supply between Russia and Ukraine. Yeah, so that these are the examples of sort of some of the cyber warfare, so people understand what we are actually talking about from the technical perspective.
No, absolutely. And in fact, if anybody from the audience has is not clear yet why we focus so much to label these cyber activities as geopolitical cyber warfare, please ask, because part of the reason why I created this group, I'm having these discussions, is because the professionals and the general public need to be aware of this. And if we're not aware of this, we are not able to distinguish between useless legislation or legislation that might look like it's serving the public good from stuff like, for example, what Australia is considering. And as citizens, and, you know, I don't know where most people are calling in and joining from, but, you know, for most of us who are living in Western democracies, you know, what distinguishes us from the rest of the world is because the nations we reside in, our freedoms and our democracies are protected and enshrined by law or by constitution. Whether we use them well enough or we leverage them well enough to serve us as citizens, that's a different question. But I don't expect somebody who lives in a country where some secret service can come and pick them up at 3 a.m. and they disappear, to go and champion democratic value in their country. But I do expect this of us who live in Western democracies, because we have laws that can protect us to a large extent, not to a small extent. And as long as we are exercising our civic duties, speaking about things that do address our democratic value, our ability to actually question our public officials and question them with validity and authenticity, not just, you know, false narratives and baloney stuff. That's our civic duty. And it's important for us to know this, because unless we know this, there is so much that could go, that can be done in our name that end up hurting so many people. Case in point, ladies and gentlemen, how many of you remember the launch of the war on Iraq by the international international community? It was supposed to be because Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. It turned out to be a lie, and 1 million Iraqis died from this. And if I remember correctly, I was in London at the time when more than 2 million people marched on Downing Street when Tony Blair was in power, saying, "We don't approve of this war." The general, the public opinion against that invasion of Iraq back then was close to 70-80% who were against the war. But guess what? Tony Blair had majority in Parliament, and Parliament decided to go to war, and the UK went to war, and as a result, you know, 1 million Iraqis died from this, and it was for the wrong reasons. My point here is we're now seeing the same thing happening on different scales. Those who have what is called the legitimacy of being the officials in the place where laws are enacted or passed, they're the ones who rule the day, and they're not the ones that these laws are not serving the public interest. So this is why I create this. So anybody that has a question, please go ahead and raise your hand, and I'm happy to give you the floor.
Khalid, I believe some questions have been posted in the chat already.
Okay, let's have a look. Okay. Let's see. By the way, I'm not a fast reader. I'm going to read it. So Walter here says, sorry, friends, but nuclear war is possible. My president is a little crazy. Well, you know what? Unfortunately, all presidents that we have today running many countries are crazy. I mean, I'm sorry. I'll go on the record. Do you really think that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, has the intellect that everybody claims he does? You know, I'm sorry. I called him a buffoon before. When he first started being prime minister, he still acts like a buffoon. What about President Biden? Half of the time he's asleep. Our public officials, wherever country we're in, have to be held to public account. That's the key point. And if we don't hold them as citizens to public account, they will end up doing some major mistakes. And I've seen major mistakes by everybody, including your president, Mr. Walter, and including Boris Johnson and Biden. Don't get me started. Kim Murphy says, thank you, Walter. We know. I hope you are safe. I saw that he did what he did to your soldiers. I think this is like an internal conversation. Kim also added release this on cybersecurity. Okay, these are links. Laws. Okay, Bernadette says, laws have never been about justice. They're about compliance with the status quo created by those in control. Bernadette, I could not agree with you more. It's something I talk to a great extent in my book, which is coming out in a matter of a few weeks, titled Survivability. I'll post a link for people to see what the book is about, and feel free to go and register for release date updates and etc. And it is about the status quo, and it's the way it is to control. And in fact, if you recall how, when the economic crisis happened in 2008, we all heard how much how many promises were made that the system will be done, things will be fixed, the system will be updated, blah, blah, blah. And then guess what? Nothing was changed. In fact, the people who perpetrated the horrors of 2008 economic crisis are still in charge. And they are also doing their controlling, and they're the ones who are supplying the funds for re-election for many of the people in power. Same thing is happening with COVID. You know, the post-COVID world is going to be either worse or better. It depends whether we, the people, let those who are in control, who are trying to reserve it to their benefit, whether we can alter that and at least make it serve the public interest. I think also Kim Murphy would like to have something to say. Kim, the floor is yours.
Are you able? Khaled, you have to bring Kim up to stage. Do you want me to come on with you?
Yes, please go ahead, Gutta.
You have to make me a moderator.
Let's see. Make you a moderator. You are now a moderator.
Okay, and I'll bring people up.
Kim, if you can unmute yourself, the floor is yours, please. What is your point?
Sounds like Kim had some connection problem, Khaled. Let's see if
Kim, let me invite to speak. You're invited to speak, Kim, one more time. Let's see if you're there. I can't see you there, Kim.
I'm pulling her as well. In a while, I'm going to do a reset in the room. This is the Cyber War and Peace Cyber Warfare Club. please click the green house to follow the club and in Khaled and Sam's profiles. These rooms are going to happen daily at 7 p.m. London English time, London time, and it's about what you see, cyber war, security, new restrictions, new sovereignty, and please feel to raise the hand and be a guest on the stage to speak. Hello?
Yes, let's give the floor to, let's see, Bernadette. I think your profile says invite to audience. Let's see. Gutak, could you give Lily the floor to speak, please?
You want Lily?
Her name is Lily, or I can't remember, I can't see. It's Bernadette, Dr. Lily.
Oh, yes, Bernadette, she's here on stage.
Yes, could you give her the floor to speak, please?
Yes, Bernadette, please.
Thank you.
Hi, all. Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that you also agree with what I've said in the chat, Khaled. Like, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, by the way. Like, my biggest concern when it comes to anything in recent years is just I've studied a great deal about the transnational and global monopolies that have taken place since, like, the 70s. And I think, obviously, it's long before that, because it's been a long time coming. But ultimately, like, what my main focus has been on is the way that, like, the media monopolies, and specifically the transnational and global capitalist class, have, like, built such a dense monopoly on our concepts of what reality is. And then there's still all of these old terminologies that are, like, orienting us away from understanding the fact that, like, both in the United States particularly, but really this has played out in different ways all over the world.
Right.
Parties have grown increasingly conservative, but they're still being described as if they're liberal and conservative, as if the binary ever did us justice, when really we're living in a world that's entirely different now. And so interwoven, taken for grantedly and invisibly, with these corporate logics that people don't know up from down. I mean, like, what I've been particularly interested in is that there's only been talk recently, I feel like, you know, especially in the United States since 2016, about issues of misinformation and disinformation. But realistically
Correct.
Speaking, the nation was based on disinformation. Like, quite literally, the creation of whiteness. I mean, it's the grounding idea of why some people have been deemed fully human, and then others have been, on the basis of anti-blackness, dehumanized, and of course on the basis of all their discriminations. And this is intricately connected to ideas of war, regardless. And also, I mean, when we think about the rhetorics of colonialism and then iterations of capitalisms and logics like rationality, innovation, and efficiency, they're intricately built into our notions of any type of technology. So whether it's cyber war or any algorithms, really like the entire logic behind the Silicon Valley like mentalities is the claim to objectivity of Ayn Rand. And then
Correct.
We could get into a whole breakdown of that. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to say that, of course, these ways of thinking and being haven't brought us to, you know, some actually genuinely spectacular innovations. But what concerns me is the claims to any type of technological objectivity and the way in which rationality has been pushed into its hyper-extreme of irrationality. And so we've grown increasingly mechanical, and we treat people as if, you know, and we always have under like a patriarchal, imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist structure, as if some people are worthy to be genocided and others are, you know, valid enough to be kept alive and, you know, become billionaires, et cetera.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Let me just add something which I found truly alarming. We all, I mean, there's nobody that would not feel, that doesn't have that outcry for the suffering of the Ukrainian people. So let me put that on the record. And nobody wants to see war and the suffering of human beings. But I'm fascinated to see how much of the Western media has actually created some differentiation. And even the way the governments have actually responded to the plight of the Ukrainian people and their suffering in such a different way from the plight of other people around the world, like, for example, the Palestinians or the Iraqis or whatever. And in one CNN report, the reporter actually says, well, you know, these people, you know, these are civilized people. I mean, can you believe a more outrageous statement to label one set of refugees or suffering people as civilized and the others being as if they are uncivilized and not worthy of your compassion? I mean, we can do a session on this, but it truly exposed the bias towards people towards people that look like you versus people that don't look like you. And it's just like, it's horrifying. But it also shows you the depth of the, what I call the global elitism that exists in today that we live under. And it's no wonder many of the ills of society never get challenged properly or get fixed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I'm really glad.
Global racism.
Absolutely. Well, and I wanted to like spin off of what you said about particularly the rhetorics of civility, because that's like been a big crux of what I talk about in my dissertation project too. But of course, pertaining to like colonial nations overall, I think that the rhetorics are very similar. They use rhetorics of progress, you know, the manifest destiny, and an equation of Eurocentrism with civility, and obviously used to dehumanize especially Black Indigenous folks in the U.S., but this has looked differently around the world based on what kind of colonial power has been in charge. So there's a long history of that.
Absolutely. And in fact, I'm not going to, I wasn't planning on mentioning that this is coming, but at least for the record of it, Survivability is the book that's coming out in a few weeks. But guess what? The book that's following after that is titled Global Elitism. So be on the lookout for that, and I think many of you might realize where this is going. And unless, if you can't name the threat, you cannot mitigate the threat. So far, societies around the world have been dealing with the symptoms of the problems of global elitism and racism, etc., but they're not dealing with the root cause. That's why it never gets properly addressed. So that's a totally separate topic now. I think, who do we have? I think Jumana wanted to have the floor, and she's next. Guta, could you please, Jumana, give Jumana the floor?
We are going to follow PTR order. So it's Jumana, Christopher. Then we have Lessa, Kim, and Naza.
I'm having connection issues, so just give me a minute.
We can hear you, Jumana, by the way.
Yeah, she needs a minute, so we're going to jump to Christopher, or...
Yeah, my Wi-Fi is tripping right now, so just give me a minute.
Okay, so we can go to Christopher, yes? Please, Chris, how are you?
Hey. Christopher, go ahead, enlighten us, please.
I don't think I can enlighten anybody, but I think when we talk about the cyber war, we're still talking about something that I think is studied by people in private industry or at think tanks, but not necessarily in political science. And if we're trying to apply cyber war to Russia and Ukraine, I don't know if we saw much of that. So I was hoping to get your perspective, or like a better understanding of like what is cyber war.
Christopher, I'm going to challenge you for what you answered me when I said enlighten us, and you said how can I hear? Believe it or not, your question is so profound, and you asked, and your question it alludes to cyber war cannot be addressed without understanding the geopolitics. Well, now you understand why. You're probably, for your benefit and for the benefit of the audience, this is why the labels polycyber and geopolycyber were created by myself and the MLI group more than 10 years ago. And they were to address the motivation behind cyber attacks that are not purely financial, political, ideological, religious, economic, and other goals to try and coerce the target in adopting a different political or ideological or economic position. You're absolutely right. Today, the best of cybersecurity cannot mitigate the threat landscape, because what we are witnessing today, the attacks between Russia and Ukraine through cyber, are not financially motivated, they're geopolycyber motivated. And geopolycyber, by definition, is what I've just given you. And therefore, to not address the motivation behind the attacks, to deal with them, you're really not going to be able to mitigate them. This is why so many governments and organizations around the world have been compromised, because they continue following cybersecurity solutions and strategies, and they don't understand, or they don't, or have no interest in, especially businesses, on understanding the geopolitical threat landscape and the motivation behind leveraging cyber as a tool to compromise you. So you're absolutely right. In fact, probably MLI Group is the only organization that I know is really that blends both those as disciplines in the way we help our clients, who are governments and organizations, in mitigating the cyber and non-cyber threat landscape. And unless you understand that, to start with, you have no chance of mitigating. Let me put it in perspective. The greatest empire on the planet, the United States, greatest empire ever, has more brains and money than God. Some might argue maybe equal to God, maybe a bit less than God. But the truth of the matter here is, if you consider that the greatest empire had the brain and the communications of that empire hacked a few months before Donald Trump left the White House. Now, none of that data was sold on the dark web. More than 100, between 150 to 200 computers and mobile phones of people who work in the White House were compromised. And the answer is, who would want to do this? And what are they learning? They're learning the strategic plans of the empire, dear Christopher. And that also means this information is now vital to those who want to plan against the United States, or plan to divert attention to what the plans of the United States are. This is where things are totally different. You can't mitigate this with cybersecurity alone. So for anybody who still thinks, though, who, any decision maker who still thinks that's the case, they can still mitigate with cybersecurity, I tell them, prepare your electronic obituary, because you will not exist for long. That's my two cents. I hope that answers it. Jumana, are you ready now with your technical issues? Over the phone.
Yeah, what am I responding to? So
I don't remember. You wanted to talk about something.
Yeah, like the double standard about like immigrants being accepted now versus 2015 during that migrant crisis is warranted. I don't know how it relates to cyber war.
Okay, fine. Thank you. I think maybe we got lost with the sequence of the conversation. Maybe if you get your thoughts again, you want to bring it back to the conversation, that's our problem. Who do we have next, Gutta? Is it Lisa?
Can I just interrupt and add something on the cyber war? Because obviously Chris asked a question about cyber war.
You
explained the, of course, the geopolitical cyber warfare.
Go ahead, Sam.
Chris, the example that I want to give is the infamous Colonial Pipeline hack, which happened on 7th of May last year, 2021. And this attack, even though it crippled the Colonial Pipeline and all their computers, this cyber attack, actually was financial in its motivation, because the cyber attackers were not actually interested in shutting down the gasoline supply in the United States. They were not, the intention was not to interrupt the state of Texas from providing the Colonial Pipeline services. The intention simply was to get money, and they got their ransom once they basically blocked all the computers, and the ransom was paid, I think approximately was $5 million. But you can imagine, so this is not a cyber war. And of course, the Geopoly cyber attack is completely different, where the motivation is not financial, but of course, the actual impact might still be the same. For example, a gas pipeline being shut down, or what we've seen recently, a railroad system being shut down. But the perpetrators of the attack are not asking for money. And Khalid, I think you have quite a lot to explain on the, you know, the motivation of the attackers.
Absolutely. That's a very, very good example, Sam. And in fact, Chris, and for the rest of the audience, let me give you another example of what would be classified, we classified as geopoly cyber attack. Many of you would recall how Equifax was hacked. Now, it compromised more than 146 or 147 million, I can't remember. Most of them were US, at least 3 million were UK citizens. That data is not your Facebook login details. This is your passport, your divorce, your marriage, everything about your life. And guess what? That data was never sold on the dark web. That data can be used to reverse engineer to compromise for any installation in any country where some of the officials' data exists. Social security number, it means you have the data. Merge this with another cyber attack, which also was also unprecedented. Many of you may remember the Marriott cyber attack. The more than 500 million records were compromised. Again, none of the data was sold on the dark web. Somebody was financed to do this, but did not sell the information for financial profit. Just imagine if the data of the movement of people is merged with the real detail of some of the 446 million from Equifax. Do you know how much information now you can gather on the on certain people who are important, who can be leveraged to try and reverse engineer attacks? This, I mean, it's a miracle that not more stuff that, well, let's put it this way. There's a lot of stuff we don't hear about. That's all what I will say in the public domain. So, Christopher, you ask a very good point. Without the understanding of geopolitics, you have no chance of mitigating neither cyber war nor geopolitical cyber warfare.
Yeah, but everyone talks about cyber, and I still think cyber war is overstated, but everyone talks about cybersecurity. And then they talk about all these reasons that private enterprises don't invest as much as the cybersecurity sector thinks they should invest in these solutions, whatever you want to call them. But then we start talking about politics and all of these other kind of dynamics that fold under this umbrella of cyber war. But what corporations aren't going to be fighting cyber war, and it shouldn't be the responsibility of private enterprises to be thinking in the vein of cyber war. And then clearly there's like this fully developed market economy for data. There's the legitimate one, but then there is the one that is below ground. So but what does that have to do with Russia and Ukraine? I guess
you're absolutely, Christopher, you're really raising some very, very important points here. Let's also not confuse, and I'm not saying you confuse it, but let's not confuse the push by cybersecurity companies as vendors to try and get companies to buy more of their services, which is purely a sales exercise. And I can talk about this in quite detail. Versus the need to defend the nation state from cyber attacks. What you hear a lot
about... You can defend the nation state, but that doesn't necessarily trickle out to private enterprise.
That's a very good point. Remember, Western Hemisphere economies, UK, US, and many others, utilize private sector as the service providers to actually defend the nation states. In the US, by the way, it's clearly described as private-led. You hear that a lot. You look at the military-industrial complex in the US, it's predominantly, it's entirely produced, all of the armaments and the technologies and weaponry is produced by private business. That's the model in the US. Now, other countries, they like to produce their own. The point of why this is relevant here is the cybersecurity that is being considered and still followed like gospel in the West in defending nation states or defending organizations is the stuff that is being pushed by the vendors as the solution to all ills, including cancer, including hair loss and loss of appetite as well. The truth of the matter here is this is purely a marketing ploy. Let me just go on the record for something else. Many of you may have may remember the, and this is the first time I say this in a public forum, because I talk about this in private briefings quite often. Many of you may recall when the director of the FBI, Director Wray, made a statement which got picked up by news media literally all over the world, what he said, we need to equate ransomware with terrorism. I'm paraphrasing now, and the press picked it up, it became headline news, US, UK, all over the world, that FBI director says we need to treat ransomware like September 11, etc., etc. The truth of the matter here is, I actually believe, as a professional, I believe that Director Wray may have had good intentions, but he really misplaced his diagnosis. Let me give you why. A lot of decision makers, chairmen, CEOs of private enterprise, who believe if they listen to a top character, decision maker in law enforcement in the US, you cannot get more important than FBI director, to say we need to do more about ransomware. But the truth of the matter here, he ends the director of the FBI just ended up sounding like he was the salesman for ransomware vendors. And here's the problem I'm seeing. Decision makers now hear this, and now they're getting proposals from their heads of IT or cybersecurity department or their CISOs and saying we need more money to buy more ransomware solutions. And guess what? They get it. Under the belief, the genuine belief, that they are going to be good when they do that. The truth of the matter here is, this is false. Additional or existing ransomware do not mitigate cyber war, or most certainly cannot defend against geopoly cyber attacks, let alone warfare. Let me give you a simple example. The Marriott cyber attack was not a ransomware attack, nor was a ransom demanded. The hacker sat in the system for more than 2.5 years, monitoring data going back and forth. What's the proposal or solution for Director Wray for stakeholders to update their system so they'd be more ready for cyber attacks? He has none. That's a failure. Equifax. Equifax, no ransom was demanded. What's the solution of the FBI? This is a critical component of the regulatory and law enforcement system we have around the world, and everybody emulates it. The point of the matter here is these are examples that our law enforcement and our regulators, who often are, what's the word I'm looking for, induced by the vendors, and also in the absence of any strict guidelines of compliance. This thing about how many times in cybersecurity we hear about best practices? My dear friends, in the way we help stakeholders in mitigate, we tell them take best practices and throw them in the toilet and flush twice. They don't work. Unless you are able to go the nth degree and make sure your systems are better protected and you address all of the threats, you will be compromised, especially if somebody targets you. So the answer to your question, a bit along with Christopher, is you raised some very important point. It's really not what we want to talk about here, but I'm glad you raised them, because unless we understand the failure of our regulatory system and the law enforcement systems we're not going to step up to the plate to say, what can I do differently to protect my stakeholders? What can I do differently to protect my citizens? And if we don't ask that question, we're not asking the right question, that we don't belong there. My 2 cents. Three and a half cents now. Who do we have that's next? I think Lisa, we have Nazan and Dave coming up. Guta, could you give Lisa the floor, please?
Yes, Lisa is you, please, darling.
So Lisa, forgive me if I mispronounce your name.
It's okay, it's Lisa. A lot of people say that, so it's fine. But thank you for the floor. It's a fabulous, interesting conversation. I've recently been targeted, so this is very personal to me at the moment. Seems to me, I'm trying to absorb everything in the twist in the conversations today and learning a lot as we go. It seems to me that it's all made very, very complex when at the end of the day, it seems like it's very simple. A thug in a suit is a thug, a thief is a thief. And if someone is out of mind to steal data, they're going to find a way to do that. And the best we can do is change passwords and try to be as diligent as we can. But we do have to get work done at the end of the day. I work in the film industry. We've been targeted many times. Everybody remembers, most likely in this room, the Sony attack, the Sony hack that happened. Personally, I was in disbelief. I kept saying, this is crazy. There's no way another nation attacked Sony. Why would they do that? And of course, I was wrong. So 3D came along. We all started writing movies that could be made in the 3D space because films are being, intellectual property is being stolen. Films are being stolen. They're being streamed. And the value is being eroded. So we've had to just think about, how do we just continue to do our business and get on with our lives knowing these threats are out there? How do we minimize it and yet still get business done? So I just want to thank you for the room, for the discussion, for hearing some different sides of the conversation. But going back to that Sony hack specifically to the question, preventable or not? Is that something that someone should have seen coming? Was that wide open and the systems were not prepared, or is that something we really should have seen coming? And that's my question. Thank you.
No, that's a very good question, Lisa, and I will try to be very brief on this question. A couple of days ago, we did, it was my inaugural session, believe it or not, and the question was about the Russia-Ukraine cyber war, are lessons being learned? The truth of the matter here is, since the Sony hack, which sounds like dinosaur days ago, are lessons being learned? And the answer, in my humble opinion, professional but humble opinion, is no. We're still not learning because there is still the attitude of the ostrich's head in the sand. Let me put it in perspective. I'm trying to remember. I shouldn't be talking about the guy who passed away recently, but the CEO of the Marriott group, when he was being interviewed after the attack, he made a statement, and I'm paraphrasing because I'm visualizing the video, what he said, and I'm going by what he said, so I'm paraphrasing. They said to him, should you have been prepared for this? And he said, well, we're only a hotel company. We're only like a business in the hotel industry. We're not a government to be attacked like this. And it really exposed how ill-informed some of the decision makers and the leaders of businesses when it comes to how they exist in the space they exist in. And unfortunately, leaders of businesses need to rethink how they exist to be able to determine how they can mitigate. Can you prevent? The answer is probably not. You cannot prevent with 100% certainty. You can mitigate. You can mitigate, you can put certain mechanisms in place that actually will make the breach far more difficult. And just cybersecurity alone is important. Cybersecurity is critical, but alone is not sufficient. You have to have other protocols. Plus, on top of that, you have to have preparation strategies and rehearsed. And this is how you mitigate it. one case in point, when Equifax was breached, believe it or not, a good guy went and created a fake website for the clients of Equifax who have had their data stolen, to go in onto this website and put their details in as to see how they're going to be compensated, et cetera, et cetera. The interesting part was, it was lucky that this was a good guy showcasing how the mitigation plans that Equifax had also belonged in the toilet. And that is critical because he showcased this. He said, guys, look what you're doing. Equifax was, the employees of Equifax were sending the people who were being compromised to this website, which has no connection with Equifax in the first place. What does that tell you? Multi-billion dollar company and custodians of critical data of citizens behaving like this. So it goes back to the heart of the your question here is, preventable, you cannot make anything preventable 100%. Mitigatable, without a doubt, it's mitigatable, and this is what we do. You know, when we talk about geopolycyber risks, we help mitigate, we help stakeholders mitigate. One last example I'll give you. One of our clients, of course, I'm not going to name who they are, but they are an airline. And in one conversation I was having one time with their CEO, this is at least a couple of years ago, they've already done some of the pillars within survivability strategies, et cetera, et cetera. And the question was, I asked him the question, I said, when you're in conversation and people ask you, what sector are you in? What do you answer them? And he replied, he said, we're an airline, we're in the airline sector. So my reply to him was, well, what's the percentage of the revenue that you generate per year from online versus from shops or travel agents? And to my shock, his answer was 96% comes from online. In other words, you know, internet and not in physical location. So that's when I said to him, I said, I put it to you, you will need to reconsider who you are, because it's probably more valid to say that you are an internet company that operates in the airline sector. And if you think of it this way, you then will determine, you realize that you need to do more to protect the 96% of your revenues coming from internet. Because if anything happens to the internet, even if it's not just you, just the internet itself, your business gets hurt and your revenues get hurt. And guess what? This is what decision makers need to rethink. And unfortunately, although part of what we do is thought leadership and solutions and all that, we have no claim that we can convince everybody. God could not convince everybody. Even God has people who person these days. So who are we? So, but I'm glad you made that point, and it really behoves the decision maker to ask the right question: what do I do next, and what am I not considering, what am I not implementing, and reach out and knock on our door, because guess what, we don't knock on anybody's doors. I hope that answers your question, Leza, if I may say it correctly. Who's next?
Doesn't they?
Well.
Oh,
well, okay. Yes, we have a little refresh first before the next.
Guta, 1 second.
Is the cyber geopolicy?
Guta, 1 second. Leza wants to have a follow up. Leza, do you have something to say?
Oh, I was just saying it did, and thank you. And the name, if I remember, were you speaking about Arne Sorensen at Marriott?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, God bless him, may he rest his soul. I didn't want to say bad, but I mean, I'm just like say something that he said. He was totally ill-informed. While he was in charge of something that operates on a global scale.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, we then have now the club, cyber war and geopolicy, cyber warfare. Please click in the little house, follow the moderators, follow each other. Ping your friends to come and see. It's a great debate, a very important nowadays. And next is Nazant.
Greetings to all. Thank you, Guta. Great to see you after weeks. I want to start my comment like this. Regardless of what war, what type of war it is, these wars are neither Ukrainian nation war, nor Russian nation war, nor European nation war, nor this war is for American nation. As an Afghan who grew up in Afghanistan, who went through so much different wars and in last two decades, I realized this war, these sorts of war, belongs only to those who has, you know, weapon factories. They sell their weapon, they make money, their oil company make money. They benefit from these war. After September 11 incident, 15th November, American special troops arrived in Afghanistan. I was part of Northern Alliance member army. The first meeting between US special forces and Afghan local commanders took place. US forces representing their government told us that they are here to help Afghan people bring freedom, bring democracy, and build the nation and make Afghans stand up on their own feet and bring them good life, provide good life.
You mean the American dream?
Yes, sir. 20 years passed, shoulder to shoulder with American troops, we fought against terrorists in Afghanistan, against Taliban in Afghanistan. When a US soldier got killed, I cried. When an Afghan soldier got killed, my American colleague soldier, they cried. At the end, after 20 years, Mr. Biden, US government, and under Biden administration, pulled their troops out of Afghanistan. They left millions of people to starvation in the mouth of sharks and whales and wolves, and or Godzilla or anything you call these people right now ruling Afghanistan. Today, we Afghans, we are selling our organs to live our life. They are selling, we are selling our kids to buy food and survive. No media is talking about what is happening in Afghanistan. Mr. Biden recently stated that in Ukraine, in order to protect democracy, it is okay if the fuel price goes up. Whereas in Afghanistan, it was okay to kill democracy, to leave millions of people in the mouth of whales and sharks, let them die slowly, ignore to hear and listen from them, and just in order to save his economy, just to save his few dollars. But in Afghanistan, it was okay to kill democracy. What a bias, what a double standard policy they have. These kind of people are behind these war. Mr. Biden, few days ago, went to Poland, Latvia, those area to meet refugees.
I think we lost, you had a call, something, yeah, go on.
Yeah, went to, you know, Latvia and Poland to meet refugees and, you know, give them moral and rub their shoulders and head and, you know, to show his support. And which was, he said, Ukraine war is not American war. But Mr. Biden, but I want to say, Mr. Biden, Afghanistan war was your war. How come now me, Najand, as a supporter of US, who fought shoulder to shoulder, welcomed them with my family, have given dozens of casualties in this two-decade war. Now I am divided from my family, I am separated. It has been months, years, I cannot even see my sons, my family. They are stuck in Afghanistan. They are not helping anymore. Just in media, few times they mentioned that they are going to help those allies. But where are they? They are stranded in camps in Middle Eastern countries here and there, and the rest are forgotten.
You know what, Nazan? I hear you, and I feel your pain. And I tell you what, as an American citizen, I cannot say enough, and I'm not going to apologize, because what the U.S. government did in the last 20 years in Afghanistan was not in my name. And I fully agree with you in the way you started your conversation, that these wars serve the special interest. I call it the special interest, but the military industrial complex and the, and you know, and in fact, most people here in the UK, or those who are in the UK, when I asked them, said, do you know why Boris Johnson ended up flew out to Saudi Arabia? And a lot of them say, oh, because he wants to sell arms, or he wants to talk about human rights. I'm saying, no. Boris Johnson is acting as the poodle of the United States. He literally flew out to Saudi Arabia because neither the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia nor the Crown Prince of the UAE, both the de facto leaders of the respective countries, were taking the call of President Biden. And why? Because President Biden had one purpose to call them, which is he needed to get Saudi Arabia and UAE to pump more oil so that the price of oil drops, because the American citizens are absolutely shouting out loud at the price of gasoline at the pump. And the US administration, the Democrats, Biden's party, are now facing midterm elections, and they're going to get slaughtered at the ballot boxes. So guess what? All they care about is bringing down the price of oil. In fact, did anybody not notice how Nazarin Ratcliffe was released from Iran after the UK met the demand of Iran of paying back money that Iran is owed by the UK? And it happened during the Russia-Ukraine crisis, and primarily because they want to bring Iran into the fold so that its supply of oil helps boost production on the global market to reduce prices. It's all a game of manipulation. Unfortunately, what we all aspire for is for governments to act based on belief, on ideology, on serving the public good and the public interest. They don't. They're serving special interests. And Afghanistan is one of those horrible examples that they labeled the war in a... Look, before the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, the heroin and the poppy growth under the Taliban, and I'm not a fan of the Taliban in any way, shape, or form, was zero, or close to zero, if I remember correctly. That production absolutely skyrocketed since the invasion and the occupation and the involvement of the Americans. This was never about democracy. It was about the geopolitics. And if excuse the expression, if a few darkies end up dying along the way, who cares? If a few million Iraqis die along the way, who cares? That is sad. My belief here is the average American, if they knew the truth, they would be horrified. They don't know the truth of what their governments do, because the media and the way narratives are sold about how, as Americans, we do such great things to the world is what we sell to our to American citizens and to the world, not what we do, the truth. In fact, today, all you have to go and watch the movie The Post and find out how the U.S. administration during the Vietnam War knew the war was not winnable and carried on to the tune of 58,000 American soldiers that died. That's not mentioning how many got maimed. How is that serving American interest or advancing the cause of democracy and the American dream? Unless we call it for what it is and create this awareness, nothing's going to change, and the system itself, or who ends up representing us in political office, also needs to change. This is where we're starting. Who else do we have that wants to add something else to the conversation, or Sam and I, you and I can carry on to address some of the points that we started this conversation on, the cyber war and the GP cyber warfare, geopoly cyber as well, different label for it, and the Russia-Ukraine cyber war about to escalate exponentially. Is there anything else we need to add? I think from your side, Sam, please.
I mean, I'd love to add something real quick if I could that speaks to more of what you just mentioned as well. Like I said, one of Bernadette's.
Please go ahead, Bernadette. Yeah. Yes, please.
Thanks. Yeah, so like I said, one of my specialties is transnational and global media. And like, there's a long history since especially neoliberalism took off of the ways in which what you're saying has been already written about for decades. I mean, it's something where there's Herman and Chomsky have written a great deal about critical media studies, particularly, and the way in which there are certain filters that mainstream medias, as they've gone deregulated and gotten increasingly monopolized, have ensured that, of course, throughout history, the same experts that have the agendas that you're speaking to of a prioritization of profit over people, but also something that reinforces a neoliberal status quo generally. They're the ones that are looked to, right? So these are the governmental, the FBI agents, they're the politicians, they're the people that work in the industries. And it's not, I think it has nothing to do with intention. Again, it has to do with the logics that are baked into the system that unfortunately has grown increasingly dehumanizing. And so when I'm thinking about this, there's a really great theory by Herman Chomsky, and this was published in the late 80s. I think it might've been in Manufacturing Consent, but I'd have to double check. But it goes into the idea of worthy and unworthy victimhood. And that's been a big crux of a lot of my work. It speaks to what we were talking about earlier as well, with like who is seen as expendable and who has been deemed a worthy victim, right? And so throughout history, it kind of follows the same kind of definitions of the definition of humanness, which unfortunately in the US, but worldwide, largely in the Western world and otherwise, has been equated with whiteness and maleness and being of a certain bodily ability that's been deemed fully human. And then, of course, everyone else has been dehumanized at different interlocking and compounding levels. So when we're thinking about who's in the media represented as a worthy victim, of course, predominantly it's going to be like a white woman who is straight and who is, appealing to docility, or it's going to be a white man who's fulfilling all of the hyper-masculinized ideas of what it means to be a man in the Western world in a traditional sense. So everyone else, especially black and brown folk, especially someone indigenous, anyone outside of like a quote-unquote patriotic idea of humanness is bastardized as unworthy. But there are instances in which the media can decide to choose someone who isn't a worthy victim and will depict their actual, it's a literal death or otherwise. There are instances.
And that's normally, those exceptions are used to validate that the system is there and
yes. Exactly, yes.
And Bernadette, I'd be interested to learn more about some of the studies that you've done. So feel free to reach out for me here or on LinkedIn, and then we'll have a conversation to see, because I think there's definitely that angle of media and the purpose disinformation of media in the way the narrative is sold to the general public and on what who is worthy and who's not worthy of being saved or protected, well, that goes to the heart of the subject matter.
Agreed.
Good. So, Sam, you were about to say something.
I was just about to say that it's time to reset the room and just announce that this is a brand new room on cyber war and geopolitics cyber warfare. We have our expert, Khalid Patel, presenting a topic, speaking about the important topic of cyber war and geopolitics. We'll ask you to please kindly join our cyber war club. Please click on the greenhouse. Join us. Please follow Khalid as well. And Khalid, you also have a book coming out as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about your book?
Khalid, I believe you're on. Yeah, so just FYI, a disclosure for transparency. This is not a plug for the book. This is not my motivation for writing the book was not money. The book is titled Survivability. We just issued an announcement yesterday that the book is, and I've already posted the link on the chat room. I call on you all to go and actually have a look at it. If you find it interesting, compelling, fascinating, feel free to register for the updates of the release date and the book signing events and briefings, private and public, around the world. Many have already been booked. There's more. Stakeholders can request those. They can send us an expression of interest as well. And it really addresses a lot of the issues that we are talking about now. In fact, within the book, I have 10 chapters, 10 specific chapters dedicated to specific sectors, telecom, what's called maritime, shipping, you name it. I'm going blank. It really is about how you need to learn and understand how the threats that are facing us today are mitigatable, but they're not mitigable if you follow the same strategies that are treated as gospel. And this is not to disrespect cybersecurity. I've said it before. When we say cybersecurity is no longer the key word, survivability is. That's because cybersecurity needs to be done a lot better. But alone, it cannot mitigate these threats that we are seeing today. Neither cyber war, nor geopolicyber warfare, and certainly it's failing to mitigate the threats of those who are financially motivated. So this is what we're doing. And plus, we're also announcing the launch of the Geopolicyber Survivability Masterclass. It's a two-day event. FYI, the location of these events will take place in different parts of the in major cities around the world. Locations will not be disclosed publicly. The dates and times will not be disclosed publicly. Stakeholders who are interested will need to send us an expression of interest. These are aimed for top decision makers, chairmen, CEOs, government officials, heads of departments. They have to be qualified before we share with them the details of what the nature of the topics are, the sessions, etc. But let me just be clear. Again, it's if you go to survivabilitymc.com, Sam, if you can place that there as well, you'll get some more information. And those who are interested in attending or who believe their senior executives would be of value, please go ahead and send in an expression of interest and we'll take it from there. I think we have about maybe 7 minutes before we close this particular group discussion today. Anybody else wants to add anything else? And if not, Sam, anything else we need to address on the escalation, the potential exponential escalation of cyber war between Ukraine and Russia?
I think more and more news are coming in, Khalid, as we speak. But of course, just to remind everyone, the original topic from which we started was the news that Australia is changing some of the cyber laws, and there is a proposal to actually allow cyber militia to perform cyber attacks on other nation states. And this is, of course, unprecedented. And Khalid, I think we also discussed the fact of Ukraine potentially considering opening the embassies as well, right?
Wow, exactly. That's how we started the conversation. And this is where I gave the assessment that if this becomes legitimized through the passing of laws of a particular nation to allow for people to go to actually be hired, literally, whether volunteers, mercenaries, whatever, this is going to open up Pandora's box that will make cyberspace the OK Corral and gunslingers all over the place. And with the lack of appropriate treaties that will hold and prepare us for this, I hope this doesn't happen. But it also means that decision makers have to come to terms that You can't rely on governments to do the right thing. You can't rely on the legislation to do the right thing if the legislation is going to end up creating an exponential growth in cyber attacks just because we believe one side is right. The other side could do the same thing, and all of a sudden now it's open season on attacks. That is just totally unacceptable. It is unprecedented, and by the way, for the record, we use the word unprecedented quite often within MLI and within our sphere of influence. This is not because it became the generic word since the COVID-19. It's because in 2017, I actually created an investigative program called Era of the Unprecedented. So there's a precedented history to this and why we use the term unprecedented. When it is unprecedented, we will label it as unprecedented and we'll address it as such. Sam, anything else we need to add before we almost closing the session? Anybody ask any other questions?
No, I think tonight has been a super success. And it's a beautiful inauguration of the topic in Clubhouse. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Gutta. In fact, I want to clarify something that Gutta said earlier on. This will not be a daily occurrence. We will pick and choose. Yeah, just a clarification. The time will be, happens to have been 7 p.m. London time. This is the time that we felt was most appropriate and most convenient for everyone. However, we may choose different times. We'll try to make it convenient for everyone at the same time. But we will do them more frequently, but it's not a daily occurrence. What I would strongly suggest, those who joined us from outside the cyber war and GP cyber room, to actually join the group. And that way, when we post something, you become alerted to it, and feel free to invite your friends to become aware, because we will also create more opportunities for updates on the book launch and a public speaking engagement. And it's all about creating better awareness of what's going out there, so we are more informed citizens and to do our civic duty.
A bit disappointing for me, because I was hoping you're going to do all everything.
You know what? I tell you what. I actually enjoy them. If we could find ways to do them on a daily basis, because as you can imagine, I chair the group. We have many organizations within the group. I'm also the publisher of Survivability News, so there's a lot of work that we have to do. I choose to dedicate some of this time for this public engagement, because I truly believe awareness at the public level is critical, because it filters through the way we make decisions, in the way we choose our elected officials, and hopefully it will help us for our governments to better decisions moving forward in the future to serve the public good.
Fantastic. So guys, follow the club, follow the moderators, be aware. Don't forget to click the little bell to have the announcement of the next room that we're going to know. It's going to be a pop-up room surprise.
And in fact, let me just add this. If any of you believe a future topic would be really compelling, feel free to message me. Feel free to message me here on Clubhouse or on LinkedIn. We'll consider everything. You know, we don't see ourselves as the only, we're not the smartest people in the room. Let me just be clear, we're not. There are plenty of people given half an opportunity that could really amaze me, amaze us, and I look forward to that. So please, if you have any ideas, suggestions that we could make as topics and make them valuable and more educational and informative, by all means, feel free to propose. Okay. On this note, I think we can close the session. And if Sam, do you have anything else to add?
Not really. I think it's been a fantastic session. So Big thank you to you, Khalid, Guta, to you as well, and to our audience and speakers for an amazing session. And yeah, I think it's time to say goodbye.
And one last thing, the replays will be posted on Survivability News, which is survivability.news, so that those who want to listen to the replays or share with their friends, this is where we'll post them. Feel free to engage, and until the next session and next topic, bid you farewell. Good morning, good evening, and good afternoon, wherever you are.